we have our guests in the neighborhood for this fine Saturday morning. These are two folks who have been, I guess, in the acting business, have gone on audition and audition mostly for, I guess, commercials and voiceovers. And they took this experience and this life that they lead, and they've turned it into a web series, a comedy, sort of a sitcom. But, you know, sitcoms on the web don't run 22 minutes or half an hour. They're 6, 7, 8 minutes. But the cool story of these two people, as I mentioned, one of them is a casting director for commercials, and she has to audition all these people, most of them terrible. And then the other one is the guy who's out there going on auditions and trying to do the best he can, but often saddled with terrible actors who tank his chances of getting the job. It's a cool idea. It's a really cool show. The couple who put together this show and write it and direct it and act it and edit it and distribute it and everything, they are a married couple in real life, and their names are Michael Paul Smith and Gillian Penceval. They are on the phone with us now in the neighborhood, so we welcome them. Hello. Wow, ooh, God, you're very you're more awake than I am on a Saturday morning. Maybe you should do the show. But,
Yeah, we're ahead of you, so.
Yeah, it is 11:46. Oh, that's true. It's 2 hours later there. So how are things in New York? I know a lot of people are getting shot at the moment, but you guys are safe, right?
Yes, we are. And I want to say, I'm a huge Tori Amos fan, so for the first time in my career, I get to follow Tori, which is... I really never thought that would happen. So I thought that was a very cool timing.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I get to sandwich you guys between Tori Amos and Bob Dylan. Not too bad. That's pretty decent company right there. So, okay.
Okay.
Are you guys on a cell phone or something? That's really, it's a little tough to hear. So, we'll deal with it, but we'll deal with it. Anywho, the idea for the TV show, The Residuals, who thought of it, how did you think of it, and then how did you go from, oh, okay, this would be a cool idea for a show, to let's do the show?
Yeah, well, it started really based on our experiences, because as actors, we have auditioned for a ton of commercials. It's a concept that we knew hadn't been done before, and it's a very unique backdrop for any kind of characters we wanted to create. You know, we wanted to create a vehicle for ourselves. But commercial auditions are so bizarrely unique because they're the only kind of auditions where you almost never know what you're getting into beforehand. You almost never get your script going into it. You almost never know, like, you know, prepare this monologue or 32 bars of this song. Sometimes you don't know what product you're going in for. And you almost never get the script ahead of time. So season one in particular was based on our actual experiences. And for season two, we expanded on it a little bit. We made it a little bit more out there, you know, heightened realism is what we like to call it. And Jillian and I based it on our own awkward audition failures.
Well, okay, so this already, let's get to it. Let's get to some of the funny stuff. Maybe you put it into the show so far, maybe not. But what's, like, the funniest slash worst audition you, Michael, have been on, and then Jillian, too?
Well, a couple of my worst ones we covered in season two. In one of them, I had to take my shirt off, and I wasn't told that I had to beforehand. In real life, I had to be surrounded by female actors, which was not the greatest confidence boost for myself. And in another one that we covered in season two, I had to sing a pop song that I happened to not know at all, which made me sort of embarrassed that I was so out of the mainstream that I didn't know that song. But one of my terrible audition stories that we didn't cover in seasons one or two yet was that I had to rap.
I don't know
if I ever told you this before.
No.
Yeah, and it was like, do you want me to plagiarize someone else's rap, or do you want me to make one up, because I don't rap improvise. And it's also challenging to come up with a rap, even if you're plagiarizing one, that isn't filled with profanity. So I remember having a really hard time deciding what to do. And of course, the guy that I was randomly paired with was an actual rapper.
Of course.
So, like, kind of cool freestyle. And I just felt incredibly lame. I think I did some kind of old school style rap where you really only have to come up with a rhyme for the very last syllable of the line. But even that, needless to say, that didn't garner any employment for me.
Well, actually, I'm sorry, what?
I think it was for some kind of like MTV2 or one of those music channel commercials for themselves kind of thing, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
So, but let me ask also, Jillian, what about you? What's your worst?
Well, mine is a little interesting. My last name is Pezzavalli, which is very Italian, and I guess for whatever reason, I got an email from my agent saying that in the breakdown, the only thing is usually, you know, the age or, you know, woman, cute woman, funny woman, and it said in big capital letters, must speak Spanish. So I called and said, I am totally available for this, but I think this email should have gone to someone else. It got to me by mistake because I don't speak a word of Spanish. So my agent said, don't worry about it, just go, it doesn't really matter. So I said, okay. I had like a weird feeling about it. Everyone in the waiting room can like so clearly speak Spanish. They're chatting to each other in Spanish. I sign in and I say, I just really want to reiterate, because it's embarrassing, you know, if you walk in and you're not prepared, you know, it looks bad for everybody. So I said to the person dealing with the sign-in, I don't speak Spanish, is that okay? Yeah, no, it's fine. And so I go in there, and the people look at me, and they're like, okay, so you can speak Spanish, right?
Oh,
and
boy.
I felt insane, because it couldn't have been more clear to anyone that would listen to me in English that I can't speak Spanish. So usually on auditions, they have like a dry erase board, like we have in the show, or now sometimes it's digital, but it's with, you know, what you're supposed to say, because like Mike says, you don't get the script in advance, you're sitting there for 10 minutes, and then you go in, and that was all in Spanish, and it was really long, it was like really long copy, it was like, I had to, and it was a lot of movement, and it was, I butchered the language, I apologize.
Oh, God.
It was more, like, I was like sweaty, it was awful, I ran out of the room, I ran home, it was just like, it was horrifying.
No, I don't understand. I mean, I do understand why an actor would say, you know, if they ask you, can you ride a horse? Oh, yeah, sure. You know, I can ride a... Can you fire a pistol properly? And you'll say, just to get the job. But why would an agent or a manager or whoever think or bother to do that?
Well, I think what it was that the agent was told that it was okay, because everyone there was saying, like, it's all right, and then once I got in the room, so, and that's another thing, too, there's a big disconnect in this industry, a lot of, like, who wants what, and sometimes the client, if it's their first audition, they don't really get what they should be doing or what they should be asking for, so, and sometimes it's like, well, you may not speak Spanish, but maybe we will want you for a demo or a commercial, and sometimes it's not always what you're going in for is what you're auditioning for, which sounds completely counterintuitive, but that...
Oh, that's interesting.
They might want you for an extra or something, so...
That's cool. No, I get that. I do get it. I mean, it's like in theater, of course. If you audition for a casting director who's doing, you know, tons of things over different years, you get the role. You probably don't get the role, but they see you, and then they remember you for next time, even if you're not even remotely right for what you're going up for. I get that. That does actually make sense. How many auditions between the two of you, Jillian and Michael, do you think you've been on over the years that you've been doing this?
I would say high three figures, probably in the high hundreds.
If I
had to guess.
Oh, yeah. Easily.
Yeah. You think we've broken 1,000?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Of 1,000 combined between the two or each?
Yeah, no, combined.
But still, holy cow.
Sometimes there are slow months, and then sometimes you're going on two a day for 3 weeks. So that adds up.
I guess, But you guys are still pretty young. I mean, how many years have you been in the game?
Well, yeah, I think my first commercial audition was when I was 13 or 14. I missed my eighth grade trip to do an audition for a racing car board game. And I remember seeing all the kids dressed all the kids were dressed like Dale Earnhardt in the waiting room. And I remember thinking, oh, no, I'm only wearing jeans and a T-shirt. This is hopeless. So, I mean, since then, I mean, definitely regularly since we were out of college.
Yeah.
But my first audition was back in the Clinton administration.
My first audition was for the remake of Miracle on 34th Street.
Nice!
The little girl. Yeah.
Well,
the little girl from Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yes.
What was the first? What was the first audition that you guys booked, that you guys nailed professionally?
The first thing I booked is kind of like a little anti-class. I did voiceovers for video games for Grand Theft Auto, but the first thing that I booked, like, through an audition through my agent, not on my own, was actually a demo, which means that they just used my audition in, like, a corporate setting to say, like, this is what we, I don't know, it was some weird industrial demo thing, but it was, like, the first paycheck that I got from my agent was that thing, so. And then I was doing stuff, like, on my own and, you know, just, like, a lot of hosting stuff and, you know, that's how a lot of these people... A lot of us start is just looking for things on your own and just getting
stuff. What do you mean by hosting? I'm not sure what you mean by hosting.
I do, even still now, I do, like, on-camera, like, video hosting online, so it'll be, like, a dumb criminal who gets arrested wearing a shirt that says it's all fun and games till the cop shows up, and then in his mugshot, that's the shirt that he's wearing, or, like...
It's a great example.
Yeah, and that's a true thing that happened in Florida, of course. They're usually always in Florida. Or, you know, like, casting news and rumors about Game of Thrones or things like that. So I'm just like, I write the script, I'm talking to the camera, I'm editing the elements together, and it's like a minute, and I've done that for, like, years for a company called Bud 60.
I got it. And what about you, Michael?
Yeah.
What about you, Michael?
Yes, the first thing that I think I ever booked through an agent was a commercial for, what was it? It was like a cable company out here, and I had to do, I think, 5 or 6 different accents in a 30-second commercial because they were pushing their international phone rates. And so the idea was I played a guy who did a wake-up call service all over the world because they were saying, look, the rates are all the same no matter what country you call. So I had to do like a British accent, an Irish accent, a Scottish accent, a German accent. And I think it's probably on YouTube somewhere, but it was cool. It was like a 30-second SNL demo.
That is
commercial form.
Yeah. And you nailed it. You booked it, man. Can I? Do you remember it? Can we hear it? I know you want to send us to YouTube, but...
I remember improvising a lot because, again, it was a wake-up call service, so I had to shout in this German accent. I went, I should advise you to get up. The time is 9!
That is cute. All right.
That came out several years ago, and we were at a wedding in May for like a family friend of ours, and like the like friends of the bride. May of this year. Years after that commercial came out, and friends of the bride were like, "I used to wake up with you every morning. I saw that commercial when I watched the news." Like asking Mike to do impressions at the wedding. He was the guy. It became a thing.
Well, after all these years, and you've gotten other commercials, both of you, and gigs and things, do you get jaded, or is it still incredible when you're flipping channels and there you are, or there's your voice, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so fun, and that's, you know, we laugh about it and make fun of it and get stressed out and frustrated, but that's sort of like, I think we make the show so that we're not jaded. Like, you have to laugh at it, and you have to keep things kind of light and funny, and that's part of where the show comes from. If you're jaded at this point, then you really shouldn't be doing this.
Yes. Our silver lining when we're in an awkward audition situation is at least it's going to be material for us later on. That's kind of sort of our therapy, how we deal with it. But there's nothing better than being on set for us. I mean, we had all of our stress with the Kickstarter and doing our show. You know, we're doing all kinds of jobs that we didn't know how to do. We're doing craft services and we're making schedules and stuff like that. And the bottom line is when we're on a set and we're calling action, there's really nothing better.
Now, again, you mentioned the Kickstarter thing. Let's talk about, okay, I want to do this web series, you say to each other. Let's actually make it happen. Between this conception of, okay, let's write some scripts, let's get it done, to getting that first episode up there on YouTube or BroadwayWorld.com. I mean, what did it take? It was a Kickstarter, obviously, but how many months, how much sweat and tears, how much money, et cetera, and so forth?
Well, the first season we did completely on our own. We funded it ourselves, and we were so lucky and fortunate and grateful that the people that were involved with the show were very cool with payments of pizza and beer, and we were so grateful for that. So the second time around, we said, you know, we really want to make the episodes a little longer. we want to pay people for this because we, you know, we weren't going to ask them back without paying them because they deserve it because they're wonderful. So then we sat down and just said, all right, I guess we're going to have to do the, like, third most stressful thing, that I believe, besides, like, moving and getting married, is a Kickstarter. It's crazy. So
more than death? Does Kickstarter beat death in the stress category?
There were times where I was just like, if I could just disappear, and so, yes. Kickstarter is incredibly stressful.
But, I mean, you're talking to someone who just got through an Indiegogo campaign for doing my one-man play. So I'm kind of with you on that. It's a tremendous amount of work and effort and worry. And, you know, a day goes by and you don't get a donation. You're like, oh, no, it's dead. Yeah. And then you wait, and the next morning, oh, something pings. And you're like, oh, okay. Oh, I may make my goal. Yay. You know. So I know. Yeah.
We're big preparers ourselves, you know, so we prepared everything, all the rewards and everything. We carefully crafted all of our whole profile on Kickstarter. But the bottom line is, even if you're not a procrastinator, people are. So no matter what you do, you know, for all of your listeners, chances are you're not going to hit that goal until the last week, because people will donate in the first week and the last week. And
right.
Probably going to be a middle portion where you think that this is a gigantic failure and you just got to sort of muscle through. But it's a very, very stressful time. And we had a 31-day campaign, so there were two solid weeks in the middle where we thought that, you know, this wasn't going to happen.
I don't know if it's on Indiegogo, if this is the same thing, but I'm sure it is. On Kickstarter, there's the credit cards or whatever don't go through until it's over. So there's always that idea where, like, the little insecure voice in your head is like, someone's going to get second thoughts and take their donation away. Like,
oh, wow.
So it's like every little insecurity that you have, it's just like, no, people hate it, and it hasn't even happened yet. Everyone's going to take their donations away. So if you make it, if you want $20,000 and you get $20,000, that's still not secure.
Well, and not only that, I don't know, I think Kickstarter is different from Indiegogo, although they both may offer this option now, of... one of the reasons I chose Indiegogo rather than Kickstarter is I wanted to say, if you donate, you know, no matter what happens, I get to keep it, even if I don't make the goal. Kickstarter has this thing where you have to make the goal somehow, even if you have to, you know, fund it from your own bank account. Otherwise, you don't get anything. All the people, all the donations go back to the people. Did you do it that way?
Yeah. As of when we did our campaign, it was all or nothing. So
wow.
We were really all in on it, and we thought that there might be sort of a psychological advantage in the sense that our backers would really feel like they were really contributing and getting us over the line, because as long as everybody knows, you know, if it's all or nothing, everybody really feels invested. Like, wow, my $20 can really help. But it was a huge risk, and luckily for us, it paid off.
Now, what was, I have to ask, what was your goal in Kickstarter?
Our goal was $20,000, and we raised about $20,700.
To do how many episodes in a season?
10 episodes for season one and 10 for season two. The episodes for season one average about 7 minutes, and the episodes for season two average about 10. So we beefed them up a little bit for season two,
right,
and for Broadway World.
Right. But, you know, the Kickstarter campaign was already after you had shot season one. I mean, that came out of your pockets, so it was for the 10 episodes of season two. Essentially, like $2,000 an episode was your budget. Am I right, or am I off?
Yeah, I mean, it all kind of went... I actually haven't really thought about per episode, because we shot for 6 days, and it all just went to, you know, the space and our director of photography and our sound guy, and, you know, you have to also pay, like, for the insurance and everything. So I guess, yeah, I mean, it all went evenly around, so I would say, yeah, that would be a safe...
You had to get... insurance for if you're shooting, I guess, I don't know if it's your own apartment or did you have a set or what?
Yeah, well, I found out, really, I'll never forget it. It was Columbus Day and we were going to be filming very soon after that. And the union told me that we needed to have, like, workers' comp and New York State, like, workers' insurance. And I kept stressing. I was like, yeah, it's a show about actors. Like, we're just standing around. Like, it's not like we're doing Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. Like, we're just... It's, you know, but they still made me go through all the paperwork and all the approvals, and that was something that I was not anticipating, and I had to start solving that problem the second I heard about it.
Yeah, but
so thankfully, it was absolutely insane, but it worked out, and so we had, you know, we got to pay everybody, and And, you know, no one broke their arm or whatever.
Well, thank God. Yeah, but why was the union involved? Were you using SAG actors or something like that? Is that, did they even know about it or care when they didn't in the first season?
Yeah, most of our actors were SAG, and we wanted to be a SAG production, and both seasons were. But it was a different contract for season one because we weren't paying anyone. Am I right about that?
Yeah, the one cool thing that you can do if it's new media, which is still kind of murky because it's very new, so I'm now a signatory SAG producer, we could say deferred payment. So on the contract, it's like, if and when this incarnation of the show... all this money, then we will pay you. And everyone just did it like sort of on the up and up in good conscience, just saying like, this, we won't pay you. But we always knew we were going to do a season two. And we always said, you know, we'll feed you, of course, and we'll make it super fun. And we'd love to have you for season two when we will pay you. And then that's what we ended up doing. We all agreed on a day rate, and that was it.
Cool. We're talking, by the way, with Michael Paul Smith and Jillian Pensabale here on Dave's Gone By. It's 10:05 in the morning, so I've got to remind you that you're listening to UNCRadio.com, the radio station of the University of Northern Colorado. I'm Dave Lefkowitz, the host of Dave's Gone By, and Michael and Jillian are the co-producers, co-directors, co-writers, co-actors, co-everythingers of a web show called The Residuals, which has wrapped its second season. Are all the Second City season videos up there?
They are.
Yeah.
They are all available on theresiduals.tv, which will show you our first season, and will also link to our second season, which is on BroadwayWorld.com.
Now, is there going to be a third?
We have a third written for sure, but our focus right now is trying to sell the concept as a half-hour pilot, and that's something that we think we have. We feel confident about. We feel like these characters have legs. We feel like the concept is one that's inclusive and not too inside. So our focus right now is getting our pitch materials together and trying to get it out there, because there's more formats than ever for new content in the half-hour or 22-minute formats.
Now, can I ask you, what, you both have agents and managers for your performing career. Is this a new step to now approach, I don't know, HBO, Comedy Central, the networks? What, how are you going to go about doing that? Hello?
It's really about just getting everything together, which is part of the reason. I mean, we make jokes that, you know, when you're sitting in a really awkward waiting room, I'm always texting Mike, like, oh, this is another episode. But it's really about having as much information as possible. They call it a Bible, which is just like all of your characters, all of the information you have, the story arc, where it's going, what you can really present to people to say, like, we will never, ever, ever be short on material. Ever, ever, ever.
So it's just a way
to say, like, this is what we have, this is where we want it to go, and of course we're open to have a conversation about certain things, you know, Mike and I have to be involved, obviously. But it's just really about presenting in the best way possible to get people interested.
What would be your ideal? Where would you want to see this program? I mean, not that the Broadway world is not a bad place at all, but I'm saying, you know, money-wise and visibility-wise, where would you like to see it?
Well, if I may be so bold, Mr. Lefkowitz.
You may be so bold.
I think that this would work on a network. I mean, I know when you go to a network, you relinquish a lot of some of your creative input because they have their own people, and that's fine. But we just think our concept is such that, you know, everybody sees commercials. You can't even watch a YouTube video and not see a commercial. And to see a show about not only the process, but also just where these commercials come from, I think there's an inclusivity there, and the characters are relatable. I think that this could work on a very large, broad sort of level. I don't necessarily think that this has to be a niche kind of thing, so I would like to see it on the network.
Now, can I ask you, in the episode that I watched, it has a very free feeling. You said that it's scripted. Is there some improv, too? Do you allow the actors to kind of go a little bit with, okay, here's the scene, and do the Larry David kind of thing, or is literally every line scripted?
Yeah, it's funny that you say Larry David, because that was my original idea for the show, was let's do this Curb Your Enthusiasm style, but Jillian, who is the editor of both seasons, informed me very quickly that would be an editing nightmare for her, because Curb Your Enthusiasm no doubt has, you know, not only the Seinfeld and HBO money, but I'm sure they have teams of editors and sound people. I'm sure they have to overdub things later on to make it all seamless. And since we didn't have that luxury, it was a challenge for me to sort of prove that I can actually script this out. So I did script it with overlaps and things like that. I tried to write as realistic a script as possible. So our first take was usually a clean read from the script, and then we always did allow people to improvise after that and encourage them because we have so many great improv actors. I mean, how do you tell Horatio Sands not to improvise when he's on your show? But originally, we did at least one clean read from the script just for editing purposes, and then we would always, if nothing else, have a nice beefy outtake reel if we let people improvise, so we always did that as well.
Oh, that is actually a great way of doing it. It wouldn't occur to me to try that. It's almost like having an establishing shot. And then you can go in for close-ups, but if you lose the close-ups, at least you have the establishing shot no matter what. That's cool.
Yeah.
Huh. Let's see. What else? But I'm talking to... So while you've been doing this, you've also still been going on auditions. You've still been... And have you booked other things that we might see you in? Do you ever audition for theater, or is it just commercials? Because you're in New York. Do you do any theater at all, or just TV?
Yeah, we do. We definitely do theater. We've auditioned for a ton of musicals and stuff like that. We have our musical books. That's something that we haven't covered really in the residual. We might want to cross over because, you know, a lot of actors that do theater, especially in New York, also go in for auditions. But I'm doing a theatrical production right now. I'm in rehearsals for Waiting for Godot, of all things, with this company out here called Long Island Theater Collective, which is a new company, and they're doing some really great work.
Long Island.
It's a hell of a challenge for me.
Huh, Long Island Theater. Where are they based out of, would you say?
They're based out of Long Island. I think Baltimore was where some of their original shows were, but they got a great write-up in Newsday last year, the Long Island area newspaper, and they wanted to do a younger casted version of Waiting for Godot, so I'm going to be Vladimir in Waiting for Godot, which is just incredibly challenging to not only memorize all that dialogue, but to make it work for me as a younger guy.
Can I ask when and where... that'll be? You're saying it wasn't Belmore, but when is it going to be performed and where?
Oh, it's going to be at the Studio Theater in Lindenhurst.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it's going to be on October 2nd and 3rd, so we're just in rehearsals right now. Julian can attest, as my number one dialogue coach, that I'm memorizing 2 pages of abstract dialogue a day, which is quite a task.
Well, when in doubt, just say, we should go. We can't go. You always throw that in.
Exactly. We say that so many times. In fact, I was in a rehearsal just yesterday with Ian Sullivan, who plays Estragon, and he meant to say, I'm going, but he said, let's go. And I turned to him and I said, listen, if you say let's go, I'm saying we can't, and so we're not waiting for go. So if your line isn't let's go, then please make sure that's not what you say.
Yeah, you got to be pretty, you know, if Samuel Beckett were alive, he would shut down the production immediately and say, no, every word, uh-uh.
Right, and his stage directions are so meticulous and specific. It's like, wow, I don't want to anger the estate of Samuel Beckett, so we better get these.
Hey, can I ask, and last question, I asked this for a specific reason, if not for the radio show, but do you know the show that they're doing after Godot for this theater company? Whether you're in it or not, I'm just wondering, do they have their season planned out?
Oh, I don't know, actually.
I don't believe so.
Okay, just curious. I write a theater column for Long Island Pulse, so it's helpful for me to know what's coming down the pike, and unfortunately October is just too soon for my deadline. But I have to dig up things to write about Long Island Theater that are interesting and that aren't either A, Broadway musicals that have been done a zillion times, or C, or B, crap. You know, and I like to write about new plays, or new plays that are interesting, or stuff that people haven't seen again and again on Long Island. So I love the idea that you're doing Waiting for Godot. If I had known about it a month and a half ago, that would have been helpful. But I don't.
Well, we'll have to keep in touch with you anyway about the various goings-on.
Yeah, that'd be cool. And Jillian, I'm sorry I've been leaving you out of the conversation. What about stuff that you've been doing either now or recently, or stuff that you're going up for?
I do my hosting stuff. I don't do any theater, so that's a Mike thing. I help Mike with his lines, but I'm not really a theater person. But I have my hosting gig that's ongoing. I do that 3 days a week. I've done some video game voiceovers. I've done some motion capture for video games, which is really fun. And, you know, just commercial auditions and commercials and just, you know, keeping it going. Nothing is difficult in waiting for Godot, though.
That's good to know.
That is a wordy script, let me tell you. Full of non sequiturs and...
Actually, that would be a funny... Yeah, but please feel free to use this, but of course you won't. But in like the third season, if you have a really weird TV casting person and they decide for the commercial audition just to have lines from Waiting for Godot, and all the actors come in there and like, what? And it's for like a skin cream, but they want you to audition with Waiting for Godot, you know, while squeezing a pimple.
Yeah, they're like, why is this so vague? Yeah, where are they?
Okay, well, last question for Michael Paul Smith and Gillian Pensaval, who are the creators of The Residuals, which you can watch both on BroadwayWorld.com, also on YouTube, and also on, is it Residuals.tv?
TheResiduals.tv.
Give me another example, each of you, please, of ridiculous, insane, awful auditions that... well, you know what? Actually, even before I ask that, how did you guys meet?
We met doing a web series. So we did a web series on a now-defunct comedy site called Black 20, and it was called Network, which I think you can still see some shows on YouTube. It's net_work. And Jillian and I were recurring characters, and I call it an onset romance, even though the romance didn't start so long after. But we did bond over our sort of industry alliance right away. We sort of said to ourselves, like, you know, if this show ever gets picked up, I'm not going to go without you, and so you can't go without me, and that way they'll have to take both of us.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a way of flirting. It was like how we would flirt, and
oh,
yeah.
Now how long ago was that? How long have you been married?
We've been married for about a little more than 2.5 years. December 7th, 2012. I'm not going to be that sitcom husband that never remembers their anniversary date. Network, the show, the web series that we met was, I think, 2007 to 2009-ish.
Yeah, we started dating in 2009, so... Yeah.
And what's it like, though, if, I mean, not only to be married and have that, but to be working on projects together, basically 24-7 half the time, always together, as opposed to a lot of marriages where, you know, one goes off to one job, one goes off to the other, and then, you know, 8 o'clock at night, they see each other. I mean... I guess there's good stuff to that and bad stuff to that?
Yeah, I mean, it was something... We got married, and, like, I'm not kidding, a couple months after started season one. So we've only known how to be married and have the show, and we've had to learn a lot. You know, people say, like, you have to go to dinner and not talk about the kid and, you know, put the kid to bed and then just be married, and that's really what we had to do, but with the show. Like, we had to really separate, like, we're working now and we're not. And it's really hard to do when you live in a small apartment and the show is your livelihood and it means everything to you. And it's, you have to sort of, and Mike and I work in very different ways. Like, Mike can talk about it casually, and in my head I'm just like, oh, well, that means I would have to do this for editing and this for paperwork and it would still take over. So we had to learn how to communicate in that way and just be able to say, you know what, we're not talking about work right now, and that's okay. We don't have to talk about it all the time.
I wonder, because, you know, you're actors. Is there anything to talk about besides work? Is there anything interesting in the world?
Yes, thankfully. I think we're fortunate enough that we have great conversation regardless. But, you know, you have to really tell yourself, like, shut up about the show for 5 minutes.
I'm incapable, as my wife well knows. If I'm not talking about the radio show, I'm talking about my one-man show. If I'm not talking about that, I'm talking about what else I'm working on. I'm evil that way. I mean, nothing else interests me in the world, which is rather tragic, I think.
We have that in common, Dave. We'll watch a movie that we have no affiliation with, and I'll be like, I wonder if I could play this role. I wonder if you could play that role. And Jillian's like, can you stop trying to recast this movie? Can we just watch a movie as consumers for once?
Yeah, it is hard, though, because I'm guilty of that. I'll be like, oh, that was an overdub. Like, now I'm like the editing police, and I just notice little things, but it's hard not to.
It has been very easy talking with Michael and Jillian. So now we'll get to that last question. Again, another example, whether you put it into the series or not, of auditions where you just came out of there going, did that really happen?
Yeah.
Well, the this was recent, so I'm going to try to be as vague as possible with the product because it's bad form to tell tales out of school, even though Miniseries is doing exactly that. It was for a teeth whitening product of some kind, and they wanted, you know, I did like the lines or whatever, and instead of a smile, I guess it would be in the commercial. And whatever. The point is, they had a leaf blower in my face to get my lips all out so they could really see my teeth, and it was supposed to be very comedic and hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
I had a leaf blower blow in my face for like a good 30 seconds, and then they stopped, and then they said, can you do it again? And of course, you're like, yeah, totally, absolutely, would love to. And then they did it for another 30 seconds, and I was on my way.
All right.
Mine was probably, there was a ubiquitous insurance company that's happens to do a lot of commercials that I'm sure we've all seen, but there was an audition that I had to go for that called specifically for my character to fall, and it was non-specific, and I remember seeing like a false wall in this audition studio just rattling every few minutes with people, I guess, launching themselves into this wall. So from the waiting room, not only is there a sense of foreboding, like what are they doing to the people in there? Are they launching them out of a catapult? Something like that. But it was also just like, this is so nondescript in the stage directions on the sides, which I just received having just walked in. And it made me think, like, I kind of understand why Michael Richards so meticulously rehearsed all of his physical comedy, because it could be really awkward or really dangerous. So I think, I mean, I'm not really too proud to say this, but I think I sort of took a safer route when it came for my turn to fall, and I think I just sort of took a knee and, like, wobbled a little bit. But I didn't book it, so maybe I should have launched myself against the wall, but I guess I was a little too intimidated to do so, and I didn't want to ham it up too much.
No, and all the money you would have made if that commercial went national would be paying for your hospital bills if you fell wrong.
Exactly.
And yeah. It stung people to do that. But actually, you got the sides, right? Were there other actors in the room? Were people around you in the waiting room practicing falling?
Yes, they were.
Oh.
They were marking it, to use a dance term. So I couldn't really get much of an idea of how they were actually going to do it. And there was another, there were women that were supposed to go in and play our wives, and they were just supposed to, like, look up from their newspaper and react to us. So I was asking the girl who was supposed to be play my wife, I remember asking her, like, what do you think I should do for this? And she was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Is that true, by the way, or at least I got this sense, and I know, I guess my last question was now the penultimate question, and this is the last question, but it kind of makes clear, at least in the first episode of The Residuals, that a lot depends on the pairing of the two people. Is that necessarily true, or if one person is good and the other isn't, they will sort of keep the good person in mind, or are you dead in the water if your partner's dead in the water?
I mean, you have to hope that the casting people and the client will notice that, like, oh, this person is really stepping over the other person, or this person is terrible.
But they won't. They will not notice that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the moment, too, it's just like, you know immediately in the waiting room, and you're just like, you know who I don't want to be paired with? It's that person. And then you are, and you kind of have to muscle through it and still appear to be nice and charming and, like, up for anything, while this person is really just, like, forcing you to die a slow death on camera, and it is soul-crushing at times.
I think generally the casting people, the execs, the clients, whoever, I think they want to have the easiest job possible, so they want to just be able to say, like, all right, let's take those two, and I don't think they want to tinker too much, and so I really do think that it's luck of the draw to a large extent, and if you get paired with somebody that doesn't know what they're doing, you're out of luck.
Or if you get, you know, a charismatic pair, you're right. They'll just go, oh, okay, great. Saves them a lot of time and effort. Cool. Well, there has been no effort at all. It's been a delight talking to Michael Paul Smith and Gillian Pensavalli, of The Residuals. Watch them on theresiduals.tv. Both seasons, all full seasons of 20 episodes, but they're short. You can binge watch them and still have time to go to a ball game or something. So check them there. Check them at BroadwayWorld.com. Best of luck on all your endeavors. Best of luck on finding a season 3 somewhere, even if you have to raise $50,000 on Kickstarter. I mean, that's an idea too, you know. Maybe.
It is.
Yeah.
Well.
Thank you, and good luck to you as well with all of your endeavors.
Yes, thank you so much. This is such a great way to start on Saturday.
Well, likewise. Thank you, guys. Thanks for being in the neighborhood. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye.